Hi, my name is Leighton Hines, and this is How to Fall Apart, a podcast about picking up pieces. My guest this week is Daniela Moyles, and we talked about the story as told in her new book, Jump, in which she writes about becoming so burnt out that she got to the point of breakdown and how she came back from that.
I suppose one of the main themes of the book is burnout.
Yes.
And maybe if you might tell me how you got to that point where, I mean, you talk about how you'd kind of lost your sense of self. You were terrified. You were too scared to get out of bed. You talk about going into work and how you were kind of barely coping. So before you stopped and left, will you just tell me, first of all, the point that you had got to?
It was such a slow thing. And I was so blind. It shocks me now. I think it's why I'm studying psychotherapy now, because I'm blown away by the way I managed to live so disconnected in my mind and my body. I think how it started was my health started to deteriorate, my general vitality, energy, happiness levels all started to deteriorate. And I was absolutely stubbornly treating the symptom. Like, I was going to my GP an inordinate amount of times. Definitely in 2017, I must have made about 6 visits. And it started with like digestive complaints that were really persistent and totally elusive, and I couldn't find any treatment for them. And then it would be things like, you know, twitching in my eyes and stuff that was really obvious to me because I was modeling at the time as well. And so I had to be conscious of the fact that I was getting acne, or my eye was twitching, or my stomach was particularly bloated, or the bags under my eyes were really bad. You know, it was stuff that I was aware of but wasn't connecting.
Yeah.
And then it would progress to ECGs on my heart. Eventually I got an MRI on my head, and all of this stuff, for some reason, even though I'm in my 20s, isn't ringing, you know, an alarm bell. I'm like, God, I'm sick. Why am I so sick? Why is nobody making me better? And all of the results are coming back: blood test fine, heart structurally fine, brain structurally fine. And I'm like, I'm going mad. So it was probably that combined with a definite emotional dysregulation. Like, I was definitely acting erratically. But I think when you're super stressed, you lose touch with the parts of yourself that deal with like logical cognition. Like, you're run by your limbic system. You are drowning in your emotions. And so even though you're outwardly behaving, you know, unusually or hysterically, that is totally justified to you. You know, you're like, no, this is my reaction to this.
And also, I don't know if you felt this, it doesn't feel like there's an option. Like, when my mum was saying to me, you need to, like, you're so stressed, I'd be like, yeah, but like, of course I am, and what can I do? You know, it didn't feel like she made me go on a meditation course in the end, but like, at the time it was like, this is just how it is.
Yeah. Now I feel like you've skipped to the answer there. That's what I was missing, was like the ability to stop and observe my thoughts and choose my reaction rather than just be a totally unconscious organism just flailing around the place. But that's a skill, like a sport, like an instrument, like anything. You quite literally have to either be given that by your parents or your culture, or you decide to learn that because things stop operating for you as an adult. And we all have instilled coping mechanisms that work for us to a point. And once life stress breaks that coping mechanism, that's when you get to burnout. That's when you get to where I got, where you're in quicksand. You're trying to kind of stay afloat, and there's quite literally nothing you can do at that point without relearning. I think without stopping and relearning, or at the very least gaining a level of self-awareness that I just could not see at that time.
And what was it that got you to that point?
Nothing that I did myself. I take no credit. if only I could sit here and say, well, look, I stopped. And like, it's mad how long you can run on empty for. It blows my mind now. I think it was probably a good 6 months. You know, the presenter on the radio show after mine brought me in a little guardian angel pin for your lapel. You know, because she was like, what is wrong with this girl? You know, people were probably trying to send me some signs, and I just couldn't see it at the time. But what ultimately really stopped everything in terms of, I mean, my life got so small. All my social engagements, my career, everything stopped. Was when I had the mother of all panic attacks. And I had been having panic attacks. I just had no idea that that's what they were.
Really?
Not a clue. I hadn't a clue. I just was, again, describing the feeling to my GP and being sent for various tests.
What would you describe it as?
It was always the same thing. And I think panic attacks are subjective. So what's experienced by one isn't necessarily experienced by another. But for me, it would be a very, very, very petrifying disorientation. Like, I wouldn't be able to grasp. Like, I couldn't orient in space. I couldn't remember who I was. I didn't know where I was. It felt like a total and complete loss of identity. I was just a body in space. And it was really, really disorientating and destabilizing. Actually, the word I keep coming back to, and I was on Ireland AM the other day and they asked me this and it was live, and I felt it's so weird reliving the feeling of it. Made me feel so nervous even in that situation.
Yeah.
It's like a harrowing.
That's the thing with panic attacks as well. You get this residue of fear then of like, is that going to come back?
I lived with that for a long time, but I feel like knowledge is power. And with all of the time that's passed and all of the work that I've done and continue to do, that subsides.
So in terms of what created the burnout, would it be fair to say that it was a mixture of things that had built up that were not being acknowledged, difficult emotions, but also the lifestyle that you were leading that was maybe you were kind of, you talk a lot about being busy and using that to kind of escape things. Like, can you tell me what you think actually caused the burnout in the first place?
I think there's so many layers. I think it starts honestly in your formative years.
Okay.
You know, I think it starts with the implicit beliefs and tools that you're given as a child. Like, we all learn this stuff without even realizing. We're born into a certain type of culture that gives us a certain type of set of ideas. We're born into a certain family that will teach us how to deal with conflict, that will teach us how to self-regulate, self-soothe, how to communicate. And all of those things are happening before we even realize. They're totally unconscious. And by the time you're an adult, they make up who you are. And you've no idea that this is something that's been given to you and that you've got any control over. So I think that there was a certain temperament and predisposition there already from my life experiences, a certain set of beliefs, a certain set of skills and coping mechanisms, for better or for worse. And as I said, I think when those things are compounded by lifestyle or life stress, things like breakups or far too much unhealthy productivity, you're exhausted. And I mean that more in, like, metaphorically, in terms like you're exhausted physically as well. Actually exhausted as in you're actually out of options. You haven't relearned, you haven't learned how to kind of work with the acceleration of life and the things that are loading onto your experience. And I think ultimately it was many different elements that caused the burnout, but at the time, you know, I think maybe I could have managed to get to a midlife crisis than a 20s crisis if I hadn't been quite as busy. I was very, very overly concerned with productivity. And it's funny to me now because it's so not me. Like, even the things that you get as a result of that kind of productivity, I don't even really care about.
Yeah.
Like, gorgeous cars, gorgeous houses. I've come back
to
this so much.
You know, it's so funny when you were describing the car in at the start of the book and you get a free car. And I was thinking, it's really hard to imagine that scene now where you would kind of, in that world.
It's so mad. And but you know what's so funny is, like, I never even stopped to think about that. Like, how can you be so disconnected? How can you be so programmed to do as you're told that you lose that much touch with who you are?
You were so young. Like, that really struck me at you know, the early chapters of the book when you're describing after your cousin Kate dies and you become a model and you're up in Dublin and you're working and you're in that world. And you're only still like late teens, early 20s.
Yeah, I was 17 when I started.
Yeah. And I felt like at times it was like, it felt like you were very hard on yourself in some of those years, like mentally very hard on yourself. And you talk at one point about how your confidence had become tied to outer stuff and how you looked and all that kind of stuff. And you're thinking, yeah, but you, like when you're saying formative years, you're like, yeah, she was 19, 20 when she was doing that.
Mm, yeah. And I think it didn't help that, I mean, in the book, I talk about how I lose my hair. So yeah. I had temporary alopecia and I lost my hair. And that was a couple of years after I'd kind of found an identity in the modelling. Yeah. And I'd never really found that in anything before. Like when I was in school, I wasn't very academic. I didn't have a real strong drive to do a particular course in college. I was definitely at a loose end. So when I found modelling, I felt like, okay, this is who I am now.
Yeah.
And then when that kind of gets removed with your hair, I definitely did go through a few years where I was probably too hard on myself. And I was desperately trying to cloak my insecurities in like every type of decoration. Like long before Kylie Jenner, I was getting the lips done, extensions, fake tan, fake nails, fake eyelashes. And again, that is so far from who I am. Like I am terrible at all of these. I mean, I think there's a place for how self-care makes you feel. Mm-hmm. But when you're lost in that, when your value is in that, I mean, no, that's a bottomless pit of consumerism that you're never finding your peace there. And I definitely got lost in that for a while. Like I ordered bum pads off the internet, chicken fillets, like, you know, I was trying to decorate every facet of myself.
I'd imagine you're getting a response though from people who are that age, because I think who are feeling that bit lost, because I think that's quite a difficult time. Your early 20s, when you either, if you leave college or you don't go to college, you go straight into work, that finding yourself, all this pressure to kind of, what am I going to do now and who am I going to be? And that's not really the time that you find that, but you think you should.
It's so mad now that I've traveled and lived in different countries. How much we just do not think, we are totally programmed into feeling like that at 17 or 18.
Yeah.
You decide now here what you're going to do for your life. You're going to go to college for the next 3-4 years, maybe do a master's, maybe go on further in academia. If not, you'll get a lovely job, an apartment or a house, a partner, marriage, children. It's so much pressure. And it's so much pressure when you add on top of that nowadays, even beyond that amazing list of achievements, your life has to be curated to absolute Instagram levels of beauty. Your kitchen is photographable. Your outfits every day are stunning. Your animals are groomed. Your children are fashionable. Like it's just the pressure. It's a lot. And I'm actually very grateful that when I was growing up, you know, I think I was 16 before Bebo even arrived. And I felt like I'd got to form some kind of sense of self before we were told what was good.
Yeah.
And even I struggled, you know, in my 20s with that. So I really worry about.
I know, yeah.
It's so, you know, like how difficult to be different, how difficult to just be. Let's say you are a little bit rough and ready, or you are a little bit rough around the edges, but you're amazingly talented at something else, but you're just constantly told that's not right. Your eyebrows aren't clear enough, your eyebrows aren't shaped enough, or, you know what I mean? You're constantly being told,
and there's constantly, I suppose, a way of being put in front of you that is the way to be. On that, how can you tell me about making the decision to, like, you had ostensibly the dream job, dream, you know, huge success, but you decided to stop and leave. Can you tell me about making that decision, and was it hard in that sense of like kind of going against the grain of what you should be doing?
So as I mentioned, it was almost out of my hands at the end. I could barely leave the house. And so going to work on breakfast radio where you're very much on. You know, I had been dragging that out of me for months and I just didn't have it anymore at the end. And my when I handed in my notice, I had to work for 3 more months.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah, it was like I was just done. Yeah. And even at the end of the 3 months, they asked me to stay. And that was hard because I felt valued and I felt like I had worked for something special. You know, it's not every day you get a role like that. It's not every woman who gets to step into a role like that. And you know, I felt empowered, and I felt like the fruits of my labor, it paid off. And so there was definitely an element of sadness in losing that part of myself, but also it wouldn't have stopped me for a minute. Like, I knew more than anything, as much as I valued my career, it's not worth that. Nothing's worth that.
Yeah.
What is anything worth? I mean, all we have in this world is our mind. The quality of your mind is the quality of your life. If it's not in a good place, if you're not in a good place, you can have everything and it's not going to mean anything to you. So it was definitely sad, and I waited a few months before I went traveling. I think I stayed in Ireland for 3 months after I finished the job, and I did a lot of therapy, and I tried to kind of decide, am I staying here? Am I going?
Did you find the therapy helpful?
Yes. Okay. Very well. I can say that now, but at the time, like, I also hated her. You know, like, you know, I hated her. I hated the room.
Yeah.
I hated all the things it confronted me with.
Yeah.
I hated the fact that it made me leave my bedroom and I had to walk there, and it was stressful to me. Really, my life got very small. Like, I would only kind of go outside the house for either therapy, which was twice a week, or every now and again to try yoga or something that I was being told would help me that didn't at first and then gradually did. But that, again, everything takes time. I wish so much that there was just one quick fix, and I would love that. I'd love to say, here is the prescription, here's the manual that you follow. But, you know, things are messy, and it's messy to get to that point, so it's a little bit messy to get out.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting when you went traveling, that you at two points along the way, like, first of all, originally, and then later when you go to Patagonia, you talk about, you kind of one step forward, two step back. That it wasn't like 10. I went and it was amazing and I was fixed, and it took you a good while even to kind of get started on properly. Like you say, at some points when you went traveling, you're listing off all the activities that you're doing. You're like, I was basically doing the same thing. I was keeping busy.
100%. Like, we are ingrained in our patterns of behavior. It is hard to stop and change those things. You have to rewire your brain. So when I left, I was the same person in a different place doing the same thing. And I actually fully believe now that while the travel is a beautiful backdrop to the book and it was an incredible experience in my life, the work I did, the travel and the inner work, is mutually exclusive. It just so happened for me that the inner journey and the outer journey happened together. But I think you can do that work at home. You can do it in your bedroom. You can do it in your parents' house. You can do it wherever. Because when I left, I was the same person making the same mistakes in a kind of an adapted way for about 6 months.
Really? And what started the inner journey?
I think realizing that I was doing the same thing in a different way.
Okay.
It was undeniable. Like, so the stress fell away when I left, because obviously if you leave, that every trigger, every little bit of responsibility, you get a brief relief. And that's exactly what happened. When I left Ireland, when I left every email, every person, every responsibility, everything, I was like, oh my God. And I thought, this is it. I'm fixed. And that's not the case. I just started doing the same thing in a different way. So yeah, I found productivity in travel. I found escapism in drugs. I found I was just completely numbing and running.
Yeah.
And I think we can spend our whole lives doing that. Some people do. But what made me kind of stop was probably a combination of the shame of the terrible hangovers and the constant missed flights, and the draining of my savings account.
That scene where you described the night in LA where you go out on a big night before you've got an early flight, and then your friend kind of, you ring your brother and you're like, I love you, and you ring your friends, and then one of your friends says, give the phone to the person you're staying with, and you have this awful night of being wide awake and just feeling horrendous. And I just that was really beautifully written. Like, you could so picture it.
But the thing is, when you're in that headspace anyway, you're so depleted of your serotonin, you're so depleted of those things, that when you're further depleting them, I mean, the come down is horrendous. You have to take a look at yourself in those moments, because you're not operating from a normal level of chemicals. You know, you're already all over the place. So it was probably those experiences that made me take stock and realize that I was doing the same thing in another way. And, you know, like when I sit here and tell this story, I am sometimes like, Jesus Christ, what a privilege. What a privilege to have had that time and those resources to fuck up like that over and over and over. And then finally figure it out, you know. And even when I did figure it out, as you mentioned, it was one step forward, five steps back, one step forward, two steps back. I had to battle with my conditioning to repress, with my conditioning to reframe or deny or overlook or, you know, to really take off the mask took a lot of time and to sit with yourself.
Was the start of it putting yourself in situations that you were scared of and pushing through and doing it? Was that the first thing that...
That was actually a parallel kind of experiment.
Okay.
So for me, one of the things I consciously decided to do when I went traveling, because I was so debilitatingly scared of anxiety and because I knew that anxiety manifested as fear, I said, I'm going to really challenge my experience of fear. So I'm going to see if I can give myself like a self-prescribed remedy here for anxiety. And so on this journey, at every point I could, I kept trying to scare the shit out of myself. And you know what? It did actually really amaze me in ways I never expected. My God, your mind tells you some lies. And they are so self-limiting. And you believe them like they are fact. Like, I could never do that. And you're like, that is fact. And then you do it and you're like, what? Like, I was so sure I could never do that. And I believed these things like they were concrete, solid fact. And it was only for the case, or it was only because I was in this totally unconventional, almost surreal world anyway, that I just was like, well, sure, feck it. If I jump off this and I do die, like my brain's telling me, let's just see. And then it never happened like that. And it was so fascinating to slowly erode away at that self-limiting belief. It was really liberating. But the points where I think I started to actually do the inner journey was really, really mundane and unexciting. Not like that at all. It was on like really long bus journeys.
Okay.
Where I never in my adult life was I forced to sit down quietly with myself. Like, I would have my phone, I would have my laptop, I would have my headphones, my podcast playlists, books, whatever. I never, ever, ever sat on my own. So when I was traveling and I was on these huge bus journeys for 18 hours, sitting beside a guy who'd fallen asleep on my shoulder, the curtains are pulled, I've nowhere to look, there's no TVs, like the bus isn't like that. My Kindle's died because I'm not carrying around books because it's too heavy in your backpack. My phone has died and I just have me and I'm just sitting there. Like, I couldn't believe how uncomfortable I was in my own skin. I was like writhing because I'd never done that. Never in my 30 years. I'd never sat without something in my hand, without a friend to go to, somebody to call or talk to. It was utter boredom that brought me to having to turn to my own mind. And when I had to turn to my own mind, it was undeniable. It's self-awareness. It's introspection in a way that I'd never... It was getting to know myself, listening to myself, and then questioning my own thoughts, being like, what is
really
this? So actually the journey was really unexciting. That inner journey was really unexciting, but it did happen in parallel with some much more exciting fear.
You describe it really well though, because that is it's a hard thing to kind of you know, to write about, because it's happening. There's one point where you describe kind of what you referenced there, where you say in relationships, for example, that you were either one extreme or another. You were independent and really cold, but actually needy and just stay with me and put your arms around me, underneath it, or on the other hand. And then how that gradually that kind of mellowed out, and you kind of are set, like a lot of the book is about you're kind of settling in the middle after facing, you know, sitting with yourself and coming to terms.
Oftentimes I think the defense mechanisms that we cloak ourselves in are in direct opposition to how we actually feel, because that's what feels safe. So I think really when it came to relationships, like romantic relationships, I probably was anxious. I probably did feel like, well, am I good enough if I show you who I am and you say no? Can I hold space for that? Can I hold that feeling? And I just didn't feel like I could. I didn't feel like I hadn't grown those roots. I didn't love myself enough. I didn't trust myself enough. So if somebody implied that I wasn't good enough. Mm. I felt like I'd crumble. So I think to manage that, I just wouldn't let myself go. Mm. I would be super independent, cold, very destructive. Mm. I was always trying to push the relationship away and in very unhealthy ways. And I write about that really openly. Yeah, one of my ex-boyfriends stayed at me for 4 years, and you know, he was an incredible person and is an incredible person, and I think I learned so much about how to love from him, but I also feel so guilty that that was the version of me he got, because I just, and I loved him so much, but I just couldn't. I just couldn't do it. Mm. And after that relationship ended, it was a huge kick in the arse. Like I couldn't shake the shame and the guilt that I felt for having put somebody who I knew I loved through that, because I couldn't own my own feelings or communicate properly, or, you know, that I couldn't manage my own probably irrational rumination about what might be.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If these future events might happen, you know, who knows? Maybe if I had been able to open up, it would have actually been better than I ever thought.
Mm.
But that never got to materialize, because I just didn't have those skills and I didn't have that self-awareness. Mm. So much of that behavior was totally unconscious. Mm. Like, I wasn't deciding to do it in the moment. But I do strangely recall having thoughts of going, you're pushing him away. He's going to leave you. But yet I couldn't stop. And so does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't deciding to behave like that. It was just a total reaction.
Mm.
Yet I would have these thoughts afterwards that was like, why are you doing this? That's not you. You're going to lose him. Why are you hurting him? And I couldn't stop.
And do you think it was the overriding emotion was fear that was driving
it? Total fear. Yeah. Total. And as I said, like, it was more than just that. It was fear for my own ability to cope with I didn't love myself. I didn't trust myself. If somebody had alluded to the fact, if somebody that I loved didn't love me back, I would have just fallen apart.
Mm.
I didn't have that strength of character. I didn't have that resilience. I hadn't built that self-love at all. And because this person was I just idolized them. They were on this pedestal.
Mm.
If they were to tell me I wasn't good enough, well, then I'm just not good enough.
Mm.
And that's it. That's how it felt to me. But yeah, I was so rattled after that relationship ended that I think it started a chain of events. I think it started the burnout. I think it started the breakdown.
Yeah.
It was the straw that broke the camel's back of not coping.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like I got it right straight after that. I didn't. Mm. My next relationship, I went in going, I'm never making those mistakes. Mm. And I was totally codependent.
Mm.
I went the complete pendulum swing.
Mm.
I was like, I'm going to be so nurturing, so in love. I'm going to let him know I love him every day. Like, it was one extreme to the other extreme. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is so noxious. Like, it's not healthy either. It's like, where are you? What are you doing? Call me 500 times. Like, I went from being totally independent. Like, I want to go here on the map. And, oh, well, I don't really want to go there. Okay, well, I'm going. And I would go the next day on my own and I wouldn't even think.
Mm.
To literally not being able to function if this person wasn't in my life every minute of the day.
Mm.
So that in itself was another unhealthy manifestation of trying to right what you'd wronged in the past. Mm. You know, you're trying to make up for your mistakes by doing something different in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still single, so I still haven't figured it out. But my relationship after that, I felt like was I met this guy when I was traveling, and it was an incredible love story. And I talk about it in the book, and it to this day, the memories we made are just irreplaceable and will be with me forever. But I found peace in myself in that it was the best I'd ever done.
Mm.
And I was stronger at that point. Mm. I felt like I love me now.
Yeah.
I trust me now. So this is my best. And if it's not good enough, I can actually handle that now.
Okay.
And that was big growth for me.
And do you think that kind of earlier lack of self-love and all that fear, and was that just kind of who you were and it was going to come out as you grew up, or was part of it? Like, you talk about when your mum was very sick when you're growing up, and how she was really like your world. Like, she was obviously is an incredibly loving mother.
Mm-hmm.
but that there was a fear in that attachment because you obviously, so not that she wasn't, you know, there was no doubt in her love.
I was going to lose her, yeah.
But you thought you were going to lose her. Yeah. And that there was then, that became a kind of insecure attachment. I think you said something like that, that, you know, because of her being unwell.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, and
for sure,
fed into that?
Yeah, I mean, so much of, there's so many things that make us who we are. There's our genetics, there's our environment, there's, you know, our the brains and the temperaments that we're born with, and then also the different experiences we have that shape the pathways in our heads and shape the things we're primed to see before we see something else, or the things that cause us, you know, two people can look at the same scene and react totally differently. And that's a result of their conditioning in life. That's a result of what they're primed to react to, what they're sensitive to, what their triggers are, what their insecurities are. And I absolutely believe that that played a part, is, you know, growing up feeling like my mom was going to be gone at any any minute. And, you know, I tried my best to explain in the book what she means to me. I mean, what everyone's mom means to them. And I had a difficult relationship with my dad as well. And so, you know, I think that that definitely gave me a predisposition to not function optimally in relationships. But that's my responsibility as an adult. And I think I realized that, you know, I realized that, you know, these things can make you who you are, but that's no one else's problem than yours. You have to stop and go, okay, well, these are the facts of why I'm like this. And there's probably many other things that contribute along the way. But no one's going to do this work for me. Like, if I want to be a happy person with a settled mind, with emotional maturity, a regulated response, an ability to control my nervous system, to have a healthy relationship, a happy family in this tiny space we're given to experience this amazing life, that's my job. It just took me a little bit of time and hurting people I wish I didn't to get to that realization.
You write about anger and how, first of all, just even realizing that you were angry took quite a time, which I can totally relate to. And then how you didn't have the ability to process that anger and show it and deal with it, which I think a lot of women will really relate to. And then how you kind of came to terms with that. And part of that was talking about the maybe learned behaviours you had. You talk about you and your dad are the same. You're cut from the same cloth. So can we talk a little bit about that? About, like, you go towards the end of the book, you talk about, maybe it's during the yoga course.
Yeah.
And you're like, I was angry that my cousin had died. I was angry that my mum had been, you know, all this anger that was in you. Yeah. But it is remarkably, remarkably possible to not realize.
It blew my mind. Like, this is what I'm talking about, this mind-body connection. How you can have these pockets in your mind, little cupboards in your mind and in your body. And I'll tell you why in a minute, why I know it's in your body. Of just these spectrum of emotions that we don't hold space for publicly. Like, if you were to see somebody laughing, that's no problem. If you were to see somebody crying, it's like, oh, that's uncomfortable. Why are you doing that? Yet all of us experience this spectrum of negative emotions, anger, sadness, guilt, shame, envy, that we just repress. They are not in our script. That's not who I am. Nope. That's not, I'm productive, I'm a team player, I'm ambitious, I'm this, and we completely highlight our good aspects and shadow away the dark. Well, while that's not true, they are 100% part of our story and who we are. They're not fleeting things that come and go. While the experience of the emotion is, those things are still in our memory bank. They still make up those experiences that I mentioned that prime us for how we react and behave. So they are there, and they deserve to be examined. But I couldn't even fathom that I was angry. Like, I was like, I'm not angry. What are you talking about? I'm not angry. Like, I was so angry I had to leave the country. Like, I'm, you know, I was so angry, you know. I was so angry about so many different things. But you can't know what you don't know. Like, firstly, I didn't know I was angry, right? Because I never stopped to take that time to listen to my mind to see there was anger or pain there. Second to that, it's the same as the relationship thing. I couldn't hold space for that emotion because I'd never learned how. I'd never been taught. These are things that, like, I do really believe that we're progressing and everything is getting a little bit more informed and schools are going to be so much better and parents are going to have resources that they've never had before. But we are not taught how to handle our emotions, how to feel them, understand them
100%,
and work with them, you know. And
we're actually taught that some of them are wrong.
Yeah, it's really, really bad for like trying to live a good and happy life. So the way I discovered I was angry was kind of funny. Everyone kept saying to me, you need to have a lifestyle change. This was before I went traveling, when I'd quit my job and I had those window of about 3 months where I was trying desperately to just help myself. And everyone had said to me, you need to try a lifestyle change, yoga and meditation. I'd never done either. I was like totally turning my nose up at this ancient Eastern science that's been around much longer than I have and much longer than I ever will be. I was like, these hippies charging me 20 quid for a class that I don't even understand, telling me to breathe. I've always been breathing. Like, what are you what are you talking about? So I would find myself experiencing this level of anger in yoga that I, Leah, there's no rational explanation for how much I would hate the teacher.
I know, I love your yoga description.
Everybody in the room, like I couldn't go back to the same class twice. I had to keep moving yoga schools. I exasperated yoga schools in my area. I was just, and I did of course recognize there's something irrational here. But again, like I've always done default, it's everyone else's problem. Yoga's just not for me.
Okay.
This
yeah,
is
yeah,
nonsense.
Yeah.
Like this is a nonsense practice is how I defined it. So in my utter desperation, having another day of just chronic anxiety, I, despite myself and my ignorance, did look up another yoga class. I had no idea what any of the names meant. I was like, what's Ashtanga, Vinyasa, Hatha? I didn't know what any of them meant. I would just pick at random. So one day I happened to go to a yin class and I'd never done yin. Yin is totally different in that you're not flowing with your breath. You're sitting in postures for 3 to 5 minutes. And so instead of being angry, I bawled my eyes out. Like I was... the behavior was so irrational. Like I was a professional woman who didn't go on like this. And I could no longer lie to myself. I was like, what is happening to my behavior? Like if I'm not the Hulk because of the yoga teacher telling me to lie in Shavasana, I'm bawling my eyes out sitting in this cross leg position. So that was an interesting insight, but it took me as most things, many months to revisit. It must have been about 10 months later when I was traveling that I had exasperated the novelty of new places and new things. And I felt like I was slipping back into what I'd left on the road. When I was again looking for answers and I thought, do you know what? I've spent a really long time examining fear. Now it's time to go and see what this yoga thing's all about and why it makes me feel this way. So I did my yoga teacher training. Hilarious. The least likely yoga teacher of all time. And it was, God, it's so cliche. I can't find a word. It changed my whole life. It was the last piece of the puzzle. I was in so much pain with anger. And I'd never taken that. How bad to not validate yourself. How mean to yourself.
But you describe how one of the things you had to come to terms with was you talk about suffering and how you kind of had this sense of shame of like, sure, like, you know, what have I got to be worried about? And then you kind of have to come to terms with
it.
Suffering is what you
upon layers of denial. And when I think about it, like to feel anger and then to say, No, I'm not entitled to feel that anger because someone else's experience is worse than mine. So then I'm ashamed for being angry. And all of those things just build on themselves and they're just sitting in your body. And yoga, when I would sit in these uncomfortable positions, because it's making your body uncomfortable, it's making you irritated. You can't, the sellotape that's holding together your rationality starts to kind of dog ear. Because you're naturally feeling a little bit irritated and then it's just like, you know, this loosely held together front is just totally shattered. And that's what yoga did for me. It forced me to get uncomfortable physically, which eventually linked to the discomfort in my mind. And I had to start untangling. I had to start sitting with this web of like envy, guilt, shame, anger, blah, blah. And I had to work through it like murky waters, like untangling a necklace. But the first step was allowing myself to. I just couldn't allow myself to have that self-pity, do you know? I was like, oh my God, look at the generations before you. Look at your privilege. What is wrong with you? And then I had to go, but do you know what? In spite of that, I'm just not grand. And that's reason enough. Let's not tell anyone about this. Let's just do this for me. And that was the first step, was like the permission to not feel like your suffering's not suffering enough. You know, it's subjective, you know? Like who knows what sensitivity you have? Who knows what way you, like if you have a sprained ankle and you don't fix it properly, it heals wrong. So you've been healing wrong all these years. Who knows what kind of things are in your body that aren't functioning right? And yeah, I just had to give myself that permission and then sit with all of these.
So what does
things.
That look like then when you, like you say, untangling the web?
It's very uncomfortable. Well, I find it very uncomfortable because there's parts of yourself that aren't flattering. And you don't necessarily want to take a really honest look at that. And then it's, you know, your brain works like this, like free association. So when you think of one thing, you start to think of another and another, like a little spider web. It kind of, and it's funny how much you cannot think of something too. You know, if it's just not in your conscious awareness, that doesn't mean it's not there. As soon as you kind of shine that torch on it, you'll be surprised what's beyond that and beyond that and beyond that. And it's just free associating. It's sitting with your mind and thinking. And I found a lot to think about. And so I would generally try and write because it was too much to hold space for, you know, like you have to get it out of you. Once you found it, you have to get it out of you. And I did that in, do you know what? The yoga teacher training course was incredible for that. The movement helped me feel better. The I would journal at night when I was in my room. We also were doing lots of beautiful practices, like, you know, we were writing things and burning them in fires and lots of the stuff that I was like, these hippie idiots before. You know, we were doing these amazing, like one of my favorite meditations to teach now is called a pentacle meditation, and it's where you, and now that I'm studying psychotherapy, I understand it from a CBT perspective as well, and how powerful it is to tangibly feel like you're letting go. So you lie like a star and you tense and tense and tense every muscle in your body while you inhale, and you tense so tight that you're grimacing, that your knuckles are white. And then on your exhale, you release like a flood. And it sounds probably a little bit abstract, but actually when you're working through these things in your mind and writing, it's a truly powerful way to tangibly let go of something that seems very intangible.
That's so helpful. Yeah, because I think that's where people can get stuck, is like, they're like, I know it's there and I'm going to face it, but what happens next?
You know, your body is really smart. Like once you start to, the hardest part, right, I think from looking back, have you ever felt like had a really bad day and then you bawl your eyes out and it's like cathartic? But to get to that point of crying was so scary for some reason. It's like your body doesn't want to release like that. You want to hold it together. So it's like that, but on a much bigger scale. The worst part is the permission bit, is the allowing, is the it's like the fear that you don't have the capacity to live with the feeling, but you do. You do. And that's what I had to get past. I was like, I'm strong enough. Like I can sit with this stuff. I can. And you like yourself so much. But you're so proud of yourself.
Do you know? I totally agree.
And it, you know what? It was only around 4 weeks in that yoga teacher training.
Really?
And I felt like it was probably the, like it was the most intensive work I've ever done. And it's not, it didn't end at the end, but I had a knowledge and an ability to cope and to continue doing the work myself after that I didn't have before.
And I think probably, like you say, it's only 4 weeks, but you'd probably been unconsciously doing so much. And I think when we get to that point, exactly like you said, it can feel so terrifying. But if you're there and you're acknowledging that that terrifying thing is even a possibility, I think you've done so much more than you've maybe realised.
Totally. And I really want to make this clear, right, is that, again, this comes back to what I'm studying now. Once you're at that threshold, that's called liminal space, right? And it's essentially what that is the space, the tiny space between the old and the new. And people get to that point all the time because life forces you there. Life forces you there through challenges and hardships. But because of that fear that I'm talking about, so many people cannot allow themselves to feel that feeling and slide back into the old patterns, even if those things are so hurtful to them and other people, because that's safe, that's familiar, that's not new, that's not scary. I know the hurt that's there. I recognize the hurt that's there. And it's having that bit of courage to just push through that liminal space. And it is harrowing. And I absolutely admire anyone who does this work. It is not easy work. If it was, we'd all be gurus. We'd all be going around with beautiful relationships, peace of mind, you know, totally rational reactions to everything. The world would be harmonious. But if you can just, if you're at that space, if you find yourself at that space and you feel like, and like I come back to, like a solid fact, you cannot hold space for these emotions, you can. Your brain is lying to you. It's a limiting self-belief. And if you can just push past that, if you can just sit in that feeling of discomfort a little longer, you'll get to that point where it's like it breaks and there's something new then. Your mind forges a new way of reacting, a new way of thinking, and it's better. And you're a better person because of it.
Totally. Since you've come home, how was it? You know, because sometimes you imagine, well, it's easier to find these things when we take ourselves out of our real life. So what was it like coming home? And you write in one of the last chapters about one of the things you'd come to terms with was like your life was on a really different path from a lot of people like your age, you know, what you were doing. And that was something that you were kind of dealing with as well and kind of coming, accepting. So when you came home after all the travels, what was that like?
Yeah, that was actually tough in itself.
Was it? Yeah,
definitely. It wasn't an easy thing. Like when I came home to go to a couple of my friends' weddings in the summer before going back to college in the September.
Okay.
And, you know, I moved back in with my parents. I'm 31. And it didn't seem like moving to Dublin was going to be an option anytime soon, considering the rent and my college fees. And it was a lot to face because I am 31 and I'm the only single girl in my group of friends. And if they're not in long-term relationships, they're married or starting families, that becomes very stark when you move home. That's easy to deny when you're away. It's easy to ignore. And it's not because I feel like I'm allowing myself the time and space to figure things out, I said, okay, well, we're not going to take on all the world's problems right now. We're going to just get used to the transition of being back in Ireland. We're going to get through the Irish winter as opposed to being in Bali. We're going to get back into the headspace of studying and try and establish, you know, I've always worked for myself. I've never been employed. Even when I worked for Spin, I was contracted. I've always been self-employed. So I said, okay, let's take it step by step and just try and get reestablished in terms of career. And so that's kind of where I'm at. I've been home actually 12 months this month. And it took a good six to feel like I was comfortable again. I was constantly wanting to leave. And I had to sit with that feeling. You know, I had to sit with that urge to run away. Because that's not the answer either. That really isn't the answer. Like, I want to live a fulfilling life. I want to contribute. And if I want to contribute and do something that's bigger than me, I have to go do this course. I have to build this resource that I'm working on. I have to give myself the skills to do the job that I want to do to help other people. And that's delayed gratification. Like, you can't just be on the beaches constantly if you want to do something like that. So I accepted that. I sat with it. And, you know, there's more challenges that I'll have to face. Like, as I said, I have to think about if I want to start a family and what that looks like for me. And there's always going to be challenges. Like, life is a relentless stream of challenges. But I'm trying now to find the fun in that. I'm trying to find the challenge in it, the growth in it, and to always maintain the peace of mind and the lessons that I learned during that time.
Yeah, that was the last thing I wanted to ask you. I heard you say that in an interview, it was either with Brendan O'Connor or Louise McSharry during the week, that you know that's your priority every day, that you check in. And I think that's one of the things your book's going to be so helpful right at the moment, because I think a lot of, well, I and a lot of people I've spoken to this week, and I'm sure we'll be feeling for the next few weeks, are feeling a lot of anxiety because we're going back into the world, and there's a lot that goes with that, and it's overwhelming. And I think we are, a lot of us are very anxious. And you said that you, like, that now is an absolute priority for you every day to check on your anxiety levels and to make maintaining, you know, kind of managing them.
Yeah.
One of the things you do.
I think there's this like farcical idea that you get over anxiety, that means you're dead. Like it's a normal human emotion. It's part of your, it's the same as happiness. Like you, it's the way that you manage or address anxiety or the way that you, it's the frillings that you add to it. If it's this big, scary demon, it's going to be a big, scary demon. So I think that was great learning to what's the word I'm looking for?
Come to terms with the fact that it'll always be there,
or to kind of repaint it.
Okay.
It's not as big to me anymore. But with that said, I'm very conscious when I come back home that it's very easy for me to slip back into that do as you're told mentality, to tick the boxes. And I saw where that got me before. And that means going a little bit against the grain to not do that. And that can be scary because it's not as conventional. It's not as, it's not what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
So you don't have the same benchmarks. You don't have the same topics of conversation necessarily. And that you can feel a little bit isolated in that. But I know my peace of mind lies there.
Yeah.
And so I have to check in with myself every day. Like for me, the marker of my success now is a slow morning. A slow morning where I take time for myself to just sit with my coffee or my tea or whatever, and not getting up and just run, like from the moment you open your eyes, you don't even have a breath to just settle and ground. So that's one thing that I try to do every day. And when I'm making decisions now around work or around anything, I just try to check in and make sure it's what's authentic, what's in line with what I've learned, what's in line with where I want to go, and not just kind of a mindless yes or a mindless no. So that's been a big help. Let's hope I can maintain that.
I'm sure you will. Tanya, thank you so much for speaking to me. I really appreciate it.